listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 419.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Station, and this the second part of the extremely popular interview with the one and only Chris Townsend regarding his recent 450-mile walk from Yosemite Valley to Death Valley. In this episode, we get to hear more about how busy Chris is when he's in camp, what it feels like to walk across a desert, his thoughts on remote personal safety, and a close encounter of the bear kind, plus, of course, a bit about gear. The January TGO magazine has just been published as I record this, and that contains additional detail you may enjoy. Of course, the Outdoor Station website also has photos, information, and links to all related to the chat. While you're on our website, please join the newsletter page if you haven't already and make future suggestions of people to talk to. There's also our monthly competition, and that's to win over £150 worth of hammock camping gear. From every entry, we get a small donation, which helps pay for the bandwidth of our daily 2,500 to 3,000 downloads. The November winner was Sarah Lawrence, and she's already tweeted at receiving her prize, which was the Evinu Titanium Cook Set. So the more support we get for our competitions, the better the future prizes. Finally, our executive producer of both these shows is Eduardo Dorado. And if you want to be a future executive producer, check out the support page over on the Outdoor Station website. Okay, so now let's get into the good stuff, with a question I don't think Chris has ever been asked before. Let's just touch a bit on an area which I think a lot of people perhaps don't necessarily appreciate about yourself when it comes to the trip itself, obviously, but also the wild camps, because I know you're like me, you do enjoy your camping, and that's a big part of the trip itself. Now, I know the time of year it was, obviously the light was drawing in slightly, not as dramatic as it was here, but it was definitely doing that. So you've got the actual trip, you've got your hiking to do, you've got your route finding to do, you've got to get from A to proposed B, or one of the options that you choose to camp at. But one of the things that I'm acutely aware of, because I do it, but I don't do it anywhere in the same depth that you do it, is the discipline that you need to record everything for, obviously, your work and the things that come from the actual trip like this. So, for example, I'm aware, and there may be more, but I'm aware that not only are you doing the practical parts, but you also are making notes, you're writing some sort of story which may or may not turn into something a bit, like a book or something, a series of articles. You'll be taking photographs as you do the trip. You'll be taking photographs of your camp. You'll be taking photographs of yourself. You'll be recording, I don't know, temperatures perhaps. You'll be recording other aspects of it, reviewing equipment perhaps as well. There's a lot of work there involved in putting something like this together. And then, of course, you want to have time to relax as well, as not just it be work. So tell us, if you don't mind, tell us about your discipline, your routine, because you must have a routine you go through when you're hiking and then setting up camp and then recording everything that you've done.
Yes, very, very much. The key to the routine is to ensure that I write something in my journal every day so that I don't miss out a day. But most days I would write something while I was having breakfast in the morning, make notes about the camp, make notes about, as you say, the overnight temperature, the route to come. In the evenings, I'd write a much longer piece about the whole day. Now, daylight, when I started the walk, it was dark by 7:30. By the time I finished the walk, it was dark soon after 6. So although I did walk into the night quite a few times, but generally, I had quite long evenings. in which to record. The photography was important as well, because now with a digital camera, I use the camera for notes as well, in the sense that interesting signs or things that I see that I would never have photographed with film, because I always had a limited number of pictures I could take, with digital, rather than getting my notebook out and writing down the details, just take a photograph. So you end up with a lot of photographs. They're not usable as photographs as such, but which contain, interesting information that I wanted to retain. But yes, I was reviewing gear. I sent back reviews of gear to TGO whilst during the walk, which appeared on the website while I was doing the walk. And I also obviously kept notes, any notes on other gear and how it was performing, what I thought and so on. And I've always taken the view, if in doubt, record it. It might not be of any interest in the future, but you never know. And if I don't write it down or photograph it, then if someone asks me, to write a piece in 10 years' time or whatever, that information will have gone. I mean, I realised this strongly the other year when I finally did a book on my Pacific Crest Trail walk, because I wrote the book over 30 years after doing the walk. And without my detailed journals, I couldn't have done the book, because I couldn't remember enough about the walk to have produced, a whole book on it.
And so when you say you write, I take it, are we talking about notepad and paper, or are you using it some sort of digital form as well?
No, I've, on and off over the years, I've tried making digital notes, but it's okay on a warm, sunny day, sitting outside in bright light, but when it's freezing in camp with numb fingers, I still find it's a lot easier to write. So I have a proper notebook, an Olwich notebook with a waterproof cover, and I use, waterproof pens, space pens, ink pens, and so on. So I still keep journals in exactly the way I was doing, on the Pacific Crest Trail 30-odd years ago.
What was the capacity of the ULA pack? Was it 65 litre?
It's seven. They give it as 72 litres, but that includes all the mesh pockets. I'd say the main compartment is in the 50-55 litre range.
Right, okay. So, but it's still obviously sizeable. I'm just thinking now, again, separating the equipment that you need for safety, comfort, the walk itself, the technical equipment that you carry with you purely to record the event, because you took two cameras, I think you took two or three lenses, a USB power traveler solar panel and a spare battery pack, I believe, plus your notepads. And you, and obviously GPS systems. Anything else? I mean, I'm just thinking about the bulk and the weight of all that, really.
No, but oddly enough, that didn't actually take up much room in the pack. I mean, the two cameras, which are small CSEs, I only took two lenses. So each camera with a lens attached, and they were in padded bags that I wore across my body. So they weren't in the pack. The solar panel hung down the back of the pack, so it wasn't in the pack. The power pack is fairly small, and during the day, the solar panel charged the power pack. And then at night, I could use that to charge other devices. Now, the GPS was my smartphone as well, and that was carried in a shirt pocket, because I also used that for photographs to upload to Instagram and send back to TGO. So effectively, I had three cameras, none of which were in the pack. My notebook, it's a fairly small notebook, so the notebook and pens don't take up much room at all. I did have a very small mini tripod for getting pictures of myself in camp and so on. But again, that didn't take up, you know, that much room. I mean, even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, I couldn't have done a walk like this with a pack as small as the ULA. I mean, when I did the Pacific Crest Trail, I had a 100-litre size pack, and I didn't have to carry a bear-resistant canister on that because they didn't exist back then. So overall, the gear I used on this trip was probably as compact as on a, you know, more compact than on any other long walk I've done.
And so with the combined with the discipline of recording it, then, as you say, you're uploading to Instagram and keeping in contact. Did you find the mobile signal was 3G, 4G significant across the whole route?
No, most of the time there wasn't one, in fact. But one advantage of being able to recharge the phone, you know, every night, so I didn't have to worry about battery power, what I would do was take a photograph, upload it straight away to Instagram, which then linked in with Twitter and Facebook, so it'd appear on all of them. And immediately the phone would say, there is no signal, you know, we'll send when there's a signal. And I'd forget about it. But at some point, possibly on a high pass or just at a point, it would pick up a signal maybe for a few seconds. But that would be enough. And the next time I looked at the phone, that picture would have gone. The phone was still telling me there was no signal. So that worked quite well. And I know it gave the impression to some people that I was on social media and had a signal all the time, when in fact, I didn't. At one point, there was 12 days, I think, where I didn't actually have a signal that I saw, but I still managed to post some pictures.
And which mobile was it? Was it Android or iPhone?
Android.
And have you found in your experience that to be more consistent, practical than an iPhone?
I've never used an iPhone, so I can't really say. I've always had an Android phone. But of course, in terms of the connection, it depends who the carrier is. And here I have Vodafone, which has a link in the States with AT&T, which I think is the biggest network operator in California. So that was who the phone linked to. When there was a signal, it was an AT&T signal. I shouldn't think that really, because I only, obviously, most of the time, Wi-Fi, forget about it. You're not, you know, there isn't Wi-Fi in the wilderness. There were a couple of places. Reds Meadow had Wi-Fi, Lone Pine had Wi-Fi, that was about it. So most of the time you're using the phone signal, not Wi-Fi. And there, whether it's Android or iPhone, I shouldn't think it matters. It's the carrier that's significant.
Mm. Coming back to the trip itself, I think most people, perhaps listening in Europe anyway, can appreciate and visualise the experience in the High Sierra, as dramatic as it must have been to be at those sort of heights, and also the excitement there must have been in finding the particular path that you're looking for, the particular route. But it's the desert, the 55 miles, the 11 litres of water, standing in front of the desert as it opens out in front of you. How did that feel? What does it feel like to know that you're about to set off on that particular direction?
It was a very abrupt change, more abrupt than I'd expected. So it was almost like a different trip. Because when you're on the crest of the High Sierra, following the narrow ridge to the summit of Mount Whitney, you're looking down to Owens Valley, which is 10,000 feet below, and across to the Inyo Mountains, which are the first desert mountains. But you come down from the High Sierra, still in the trees, with a rushing creek beside you, all the way out onto the desert floor and then to Lone Pine, which was the only town I went through on the whole walk. And then you leave Lone Pine and start to climb up into the Inyo Mountains, and they're so different from the High Sierra, which you can look back and see. Because as well as the woods and the creeks and the lakes, the High Sierra is built of pale granite. So the whole feel of it is of lightness and airiness. The Inyo Mountains and the other desert mountains are all dark red and black igneous rock, and they have a much more somber feel. But the other thing you notice is there's vegetation. Most of it is spiny and to be avoided. Not just cacti, of which I didn't actually see that many, but lots of thorny bushes and shrubs. There are trees, say the pinyon pines, higher up. The mountaintops are usually covered with trees. Lower down, it's too hot. But the trees are small and more, if you like, scrubby-looking after the majestic trees of the High Sierra, again, because of the harsh environment. And the terrain underfoot is mostly rock and dusty and, of course, very, very dry. I mean, after the 55 miles, the first water, which I knew would be there, was Darwin Falls and Creek in Darwin Canyon. And you come across a flat, high desert plateau called Darwin Flats. You reach the steep edge of it and look down, and it's quite startling. Below, there's a typical desert canyon, all brown and grey and arid looking. And in the middle of it, there's this bright green slash, which is where there's water. And when you get down to it, having, you know, crashed down these dry, scree slopes of rock and dust and stones, and then suddenly it's almost like you're in a jungle, because round the little creek, which runs maybe for half a mile before it disappears into the desert, there are masses of plants, reeds, willows, aspen, dense tangle of trees. And then there's this beautiful little waterfall tumbling down the rocks, which is Darwin Falls. Now, in the High Sierra, it would be almost unnoticeable, because there's lots of places like that, and no one would probably make the effort to push through all the undergrowth to see a little waterfall when there are bigger ones around. But in the desert, it becomes amazing that suddenly there's all this life and colour and there's actually water. But the other strange thing in the desert, different to the mountains, I mean, a lot of the time, although it was desert, I was actually in mountains, say the Inyo Mountains and then the Panamint Mountains where there's Telescope Peak. But I crossed two flat, low-level areas, Panamint Valley and Death Valley itself. Now here, the flat bottom of these valleys, which are huge, are all salt flats. It's absolutely dead flat because effectively it's an old lake bed. And when it rains, which is extremely rare, but when it rains, these fill up, not deep, because the water just spreads out. So there might only be a few inches of water, but very temporarily they occasionally turn back into lakes. And walking across these did feel like I really was in a weird alien place. There's virtually no vegetation, and you can see shallow channels where the water would run when there was any. So one sense, you're very aware that you're out in the middle of a lake bed. In the other, especially in Death Valley, you're aware that you're in one of the hottest and driest places there is. But that what you're on, these salt flats, were formed by water.
Was there any stage then when you came down from the mountain and literally stepped onto the desert section that you were a little bit apprehensive at all about, you know, your own safety?
Not crossing the flat desert areas, no. Because crossing the flat desert areas, you just keep walking. It's flat. it's not difficult, and as long as you've got enough water with you, there's nothing to worry about. In some of the desert mountain areas, I had to be conscious. I wouldn't say I was concerned, but I had to be conscious of two things. And the first was that I couldn't afford to get badly lost because I hadn't got enough water to spend an extra day or two, you know, finding myself again. So this made, you know, the navigation was important. I needed to get to places. You know, I'd taken just enough water for the 55 miles. I didn't have any spare for any extra miles. And the other was sometimes the nature of the terrain. But this was much the same as, you know, sometimes in the Scottish Highlands, you can choose a descent route and find yourself on really steep, loose slopes with a lot of little crags. And you go down thinking, this is not a place to slip. You know, if I have an injury here, it could be a long while before anyone finds me because I'm not on a standard path or route. I have moments like that. Finding a way out of Long John Canyon at the start, the initial steep, loose descent from the Telescope Peak Ridge, on both of those, you know, I was well aware, I need to be careful here. This is not a place, you know, to have any sort of minor accident.
And the actual 55 miles, I know I keep focusing on it, but it's still trying to visualise how I would approach it. How long did it actually take you to cross that section to get to Darwin Falls?
3.5 days.
And how did you use the water that you had? Did you pace your consumption?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I knew I had to. Because I didn't know enough about the terrain, although there weren't going to be much in the way of good paths, I couldn't be... In the High Sierra, I could look at trails and say, right, it's so far to this pass with so much ascent and so far down the other side of the valley and then along the valley, and I could look at the maps and say, right, it'll take me 8 hours to do 17 or 18 miles and know that I could do that. But the desert section, because I didn't have enough information, so all I estimated was the 55 miles would take 3 to 4 days. Certainly a minimum of 3 days, and it could take 4. So the water had to be divided up so I got enough each day. And I say, in the end, it took me 3.5 days. And I think I had about 0.5 litre left when I got to Darwin Falls.
Did that give you a feeling of relief when you found it?
The water, oh yes, yeah. I mean, I was aware that I was only drinking just enough and worked for those 3.5 days and would have liked to have drunk more. So yeah, get down to Darwin Falls and suddenly I've got, you know, an endless water supply and I can drink as much as I like. So yeah, it was great.
And the water generally, you hadn't mentioned it and I couldn't see any reference to it anywhere, but was it filtered or did you take it straight from the stream?
Oh, I just took it straight from the stream. I carried, you know, a Sawyer mini filter just in case, because there was a possibility in the desert that I might have come across, you know, a stock pond where the water would be filthy, but if it was treated, it would be drinkable. But in fact, I never used the filter.
It's a great story. I'm really looking forward to reading it in more detail when TGO comes out, and no doubt you whatever other medium that you share the story with, more detail comes out over a period of time. How, you know, for people that perhaps go to Europe, somewhere in Europe, and do some of the trails there in the Alps and so on. And you know what's involved in actually sourcing that out and finding accommodation and doing some kind of walk over there. It's I can't say it's not a big deal. It's easy to get your head around from where we're sitting at the moment. But what advice would you give to somebody who's listening to this and go, actually, I quite fancy giving the High Sierra a crack. It sounds really interesting. Is it in your mind, is it a complicated, is it hard work to get the permissions to do this and put it all together, or is it fairly straightforward?
Well, these days with the internet, it's fairly straightforward. If you want to do the John Muir Trail, which is what virtually everybody wants to do who goes to the High Sierra, then you're going to have to apply for a permit well in advance because it is so popular. And they restrict the numbers. However, for other routes, if you plan your own route from the maps, it's not a problem getting a permit because most people don't do those routes. So if you can be flexible where you're going to go, and I'd say if you want to do a spectacular route in the High Sierra that has a name and that isn't the John Muir Trail, the High Sierra Trail is far less popular. And it's also shorter. Your High Sierra Trail, you can easily fit into a two-week trip. John Muir Trail, unless you're a really fast hiker, you really want 3 weeks. But these days, I mean, there's masses of information online. I mean, I booked my permit from Yosemite Valley to Kings Canyon online, which wasn't difficult to do. And maps, the best maps for the High Sierra, for both walking and planning, are Tom Harrison maps, which are on plastic paper, you know, a bit like the stuff that Harvey's uses. And there's a series of those for the High Sierra, and they use the USGS topo maps, but then he overlays trail information and other information for walkers and climbers onto them.
And I know obviously from where you're located in Scotland, getting to, what did you go to? Was it Los Angeles or San Francisco?
I went to San Francisco.
And then getting from San Francisco to your particular start point, is that difficult?
No, because if it's Yosemite Valley, that's so popular. From San Francisco, you get an Amtrak train to a place called Merced, where it is met by a bus that takes you to Yosemite Valley.
And you had no other problems with, obviously, immigration or customs or whatever getting your equipment in with you?
No, none at all, no. No.
Every month, we're holding a special competition where you can win some fabulous outdoor gear. It's a great way to support the outdoor station. The more entries we get, the better the future prizes. During the month of December, the prize is a complete hammock camping setup by DD Hammocks. And this includes a Multicam Frontier hammock, a Multicam 3x3 tarp, the tarp DVD, 30 metres of Multicam cord, and to finish off your hammock camping look, a DD sweatshirt, a DD t-shirt, and a DD cap, to a total combined value of £158. Simply answer the following question and text in your A, B or C answer before the closing date of the 31st of December and you will be automatically entered. You can enter a maximum of 5 times from the same UK registered mobile phone number. So this month's question is, the mountain Ben Nevis is located in which country? Is it A, Scotland, B, England or C, Wales?
To be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do is text OUTDOORS and your answer of A, B or C to 82055. Or post your answer with your name and contact phone number to Competition, The Outdoors Station, Unit 19 Signet Business Centre, Hanley Swan, Worcester, WR80EA. Entries are open to anyone aged 16 plus and you must have the bill payer's permission. Texts cost £1 plus your standard network rate and the competition closes at the end of each month. Entries received after that date will not count, but you may still be charged. The winner will be contacted within 3 days of the competition closing, and they may appear in future programmes. For full rules plus terms and conditions, please go to theoutdoorstation.co.uk/competitions.
Well, talking about equipment, let's just do a quick run through without going into great detail, because I know it'll obviously be in much more detail and with your comments and so on in TGO magazine. So we've covered sort of the camera gear you carry, the bear canisters, the fact that you topped up, resupplied at some of the main campsites there. So overall, did you just take, you know, two changes of clothes, your basic, well, waterproof gear, I guess, just in case? And what did you hike in? Was it trail shoes or sandals?
I didn't take two changes of clothes, but one set of clothes. I had a Paramo shirt, which I wore every day, and a pair of shorts, which I wore except on the coldest days and in camp, and a pair of light trail pants, you know, for those times when the shorts were not quite warm enough. I did most of the hiking in sandals, some of it in trail shoes, and again, the trail shoes were useful, you know, when it was chilly in camp. I didn't, instead of a fleece, I took the very light Berghaus hydrotherm insulated jacket, which was fantastic because it did everything a light fleece would do whilst weighing less, but also it was windproof. So on Mount Whitney, there was a very, very cold wind, and the Berghaus top was ideal, you know, for keeping that off. Waterproofs, I thought I probably wouldn't need them. In fact, I didn't. But I took one of the, again, Berghaus Hyper jackets, you know, which are ultralight, weighs about 100 grams, and a very old pair of Go-Lite over trousers, because they're ultra light. And I thought, you know, if I do encounter any rain or a storm, it won't last long. These will be adequate.
Okay. And we covered the fact you've got the TrailStar and the PhD sleep system. With sleeping mat?
Sleeping mat, I did make a change, which ironically I didn't need to do. I took the Therm-a-Rest X-Lite short and an OMM pad for under my feet, and for sitting on at the kitchen sites. At the end of the second week, you know, when I'd had the night temperatures down to minus 7.5, I could just feel a little bit of ground cold coming through the X-Lite, because, of course, it's not insulated. It's just an airbed. And I did think, if it gets colder, this isn't really going to be adequate. So at Kings Canyon, Cedar Lodge, where the store there sells a little bit of outdoor gear, I bought a very large and bulky, but quite light, full-length foam pad, which was a cheap one. I mean, it barely lasted the rest of the walk, but it did provide the insulation. But ironically enough, after Kings Canyon, I didn't have another frosty night, so I could have done without it. That said, it was useful in the desert, because, I say, you know, the desert is full of lots and lots of sharp, spiny things, lots of sharp, pointed rocks. Now, I was using a Tyvek ground sheet, which I got from you, and I don't think that would have been adequate to protect the X-Lite. You know, it's got a few holes in it now. I think some of the spines and sharp rocks would have come through. But the foam pad was. So the foam pad with the X-Lite on top ensured that the X-Lite didn't get punctured.
Well, that sort of terrain, I would expect some very sharp spikes to be lying around.
Oh, yeah. One of the things I did every evening or morning, if I had forgotten the night before, was to pull all the spines out the bottom of the sandals so that they couldn't work their way through and into my feet.
And then the cooking gear, did you take your favourite Evinu 900 pan with you and a mug and a spork, and that was about it?
Yep. The Evinu pan and a slightly smaller 700 mil MSR titanium pan, which is the same design as the Avenue and almost as old, because they fitted into, you know, the trail designs, and two spoons, and that was it. The smaller pan doubled as a mug.
Normally, when I speak to people about a trip like this, I ask them about best bit and worst bit of kit. But obviously, in your case, you're reviewing equipment, so that may be sort of semi-unfair. So what would you say was the most useful piece of kit and perhaps the one that was disappointing?
Most useful is difficult because there were a lot of pieces of kit that were most useful. I suppose the one that I was most pleased with, because I didn't know in advance how well it would work, was the solar panel, because it worked brilliantly. I mean, I didn't just charge my phone from it. I charged my camera batteries, my headlamp, my Kindle, which I took for, you know, reading, and which I had books about the area on it, so I could look things up. And my watch. So that was, yeah, a huge success. I was very impressed with that. No piece of equipment, you know, was disappointing. Nothing failed or let me down or didn't perform, you know, as well as I'd hoped. I mean, the only piece of equipment I'd rather have not had with me was the bear resistant canister, but you know that's compulsory. So I didn't have an option. I must say with that is, you know, obviously I rented it in the Yosemite Valley. The rental ones are the heaviest and bulkiest ones because they're relatively low cost. If I was doing trips like this all the time where I needed a bear canister, you can get much lighter ones, which are expensive, but I'd probably, you know, buy my own rather than rent a heavier one. But for occasional trips, it's easier to rent. It's more convenient to rent. You don't have to take it with you to California. You pick it up when you get there and you send it back when you finish with it. No, thinking about the gear, I mean, I say, like the waterproofs, there was gear I didn't use, but I wouldn't have not taken it. The X-Lite mat, if it had got colder, definitely wouldn't have been adequate, but that would have been my fault for deciding I could get away with such a light mat. I mean, nothing wrong with the mat itself.
That from experience, when you've got an air mat like that and it deflates on you and you are between resupply, it can be quite an uncomfortable few nights. So it's one of those risks that you take, really.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And with the subject of money in mind, do you have an overall figure that this trip actually cost, just purely the sort of doing it, getting there roughly and doing it?
I haven't worked it out yet, but it cost more than I'd originally thought, because of, you know, the pound-dollar ratio, in that I didn't get as many dollars for my pounds as would have been the case if I'd done the trip, say, a couple of months earlier, which I couldn't have done, of course, but so that made a difference. But on that score, you know, I knew the exchange rate wasn't good, and I just thought, well, I'm not going to buy anything I don't have to buy, so forget about it and just think in dollars when you buy things. And, you know, otherwise I could have spent a lot of time worrying about how expensive things were.
When you got back, I know that you fairly soon, for whatever reason, went to the Lake District. And did some camping at the Lake District, possibly, or looking at the dates concerned, you might have even still had jet lag when you were doing it. How did it feel to be sitting in a place with an average rainfall of 2,000 plus millimetres per year compared to the average rainfall of, 60 millimetres in Death Valley or the Sierras? And reflecting on where you'd been literally a week or so ago, it must have been remarkable.
It was, yes. It was a huge contrast. especially because, yes, I went to the Lake District, camped for two nights, walked on the tops in mist and rain, and it rained both nights. So the trails, and I took the Trail Star. So the Trail Star had to get used to, as I did, to UK conditions again. But, I mean, I'd already been for a few day walks, you know, in the Cairngorms, and realised that I was back in Britain and it was now cold and wet. I wasn't in the desert anymore. But one of the ironic things is, the last day of the walk when I crossed Death Valley, it was cloudy, which is extremely unusual in Death Valley. I got a ride to the nearest place to the finish, which is a tiny resort called Furnace Creek. And from there, I got another ride to Las Vegas, and it poured with rain the whole way. And I arrived in Las Vegas in heavy rain. So it was sort of like, you know, it's raining now. It's getting me used to the idea of I'm going
home.
Time
to go home. Yeah. So looking back on the trip itself, if you were now with this experience and your understanding of this particular trip under your belt, you were advising yourself before you set off for this particular thing, mid-summer, I suppose. Any particular advice that you wish you would have known or wish you'd taken on board before you went?
I'd have allowed more time. I was caught out at the beginning of the walk by factors I should have taken into account and didn't. I mean, I think, obviously, the jet lag of just getting there affected me. I would probably have been better off if I decided to have a whole day in Yosemite Valley before I started walking. I hadn't made any allowance for the altitude or the fact that I hadn't been to high altitude for many years. I think that affected me. But the other thing is I couldn't have allowed for the first 5 or 6 days were incredibly hot. They were the hottest days of the whole walk. They were hotter than it was in Death Valley. And this was exceptionally hot. I spoke to one of the owners at Red's Meadow, and he said he'd never known it this hot at this time of year. But that effect, and also a lot of the creeks were dry, but that effect at the beginning meant that the first 4 or 5 days of the walk, I didn't do the distances I planned on doing. But I do think, you know, I should have allowed more time and thought, well, it might take a few days to get into this. You know, don't plan on doing the distances that you'll do later on. So, yeah, the one thing now I would think was I managed to complete it. I'd like to have had more time to spend in the desert section, which I didn't have. Because you know, I was running out of time. I only had enough time left to complete the route without any, you know, days off or days to do any side explorations.
So you're on a timetable. You're on a mission, really, weren't you?
Yeah.
Well, Chris, it's been fantastic and superbly interesting, as always, to speak with you, particularly about a trip that's so fresh in your mind as well, which is absolutely wonderful. But of course, there is one more question, which is a bit of a low ball, but I'm sure you'll have a think about it and come up with something suitable within seconds. Of all the things I could have asked you about the trip, what should I have asked you?
I can't come up with an answer within what should you ask me? I suppose the one thing I'm often asked that you didn't ask was about wildlife. Not, you asked about bugs and snakes. You didn't ask anything about bears.
Right. You came across, didn't you have one experience, didn't you?
I only saw three bears on the very first day. If any bears visited my camps during the night, I never knew about it. Which, of course, is the whole point of having the bear-resistant container. But the first day, yes, there was I saw a bear near the trail, just after I'd left the popular trails out of Yosemite Valley, so I was on my own. and this bear was watching me from a bluff. And then I saw some movement, and I saw two bear cubs shooting up trees. So I thought, oh, this is a mother with bears, but with cubs. Better be careful, you know, because obviously the female bears are very protective. So I stopped, and the bear looked at me and sort of made a sort of hissing noise, moved forward a few steps, and was basically warning me to stay away, from the cubs, which had now shot up two trees. So they were sort of 10 feet off the ground, clinging to tree trunks. So I backed off slowly, walking backwards, until the bear was almost out of sight, which was really hoping that she would now move, because I'd given her a bit of space, and she did. She moved towards the cubs. So I continued along the trail, very conscious that she was watching me the whole way. And at one point, when I'd gone past where she was and looked back, she gave me another hiss. And it was just the sort of, keep going. So I did. So that was my one bear encounter. I do wonder what happened to that bear, because, let's say, she was very close to the popular trails. The trail up to the viewpoint for Nevada Falls, which is a day hike from Yosemite Valley. So I would imagine she was going to start encountering, quite a lot of people. It convinced me as to why I was carrying this awkward and heavy bear-resistant canister. The fact that I'd seen a bear with two cubs, it was like, yep, there are bears here, and you do need to take them into account. So it ensured that I did store everything in the bear canister, and I did cook away from where I slept. So it was a good reminder of, where I was.
Well, it's 14 years since you went to the High Sierra. Do you think you'll be going back in next few years?
I hope so, yes. Yeah, I certainly... It was one of those things when I got there, because I'd been there, quite a few times before, it both felt familiar, but also I felt as though, I should have been here. I shouldn't have left it so long. But at the same time, there are so many other places to go to. So yes, I hope so, but whether I will or not, I don't know.
My thanks to Chris for such an open and honest chat about his experience. Of course, you wouldn't expect anything less from him. Do check out our website for more info, and there's links there to Chris's website, where you will find loads of information which will keep you entertained about the subject of self-powered travel and the outdoors all through the dark winter nights. My thanks also to our executive producer for these two shows, Eduardo Durado, for his additional support. I've got a few more interviews to get sorted before the holidays, which will hopefully give you more quality outdoor entertainment to keep you going through the quiet Christmas break. So, until next time, folks, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.